This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about diner culture in our region. Michael Gabriel has written several books about the people and places that make New Jersey the diner capital of the world. And he's sharing the stories, the history, and the future of the humble diner with us. I'm looking forward to that.
I am too. And then we're going to stay on the topic of food. Very food-focused show today, Cherry. We're going to hear from the author of a fascinating new book that shows just how important food is to our overall happiness. And I buy that premise immediately, even without having heard the interview yet. The book is called Eat and Flourish, and our contributor, first time I get to say that, Mary Cummings Jordan, has the story for us.
Definitely looking forward to that as well. Also standing by, Representative Morgan Cephas will talk to us about ghost guns. So we have that first in studio, out of WHYY guest in studio today. Now for our news roundup. Avi, you're first up.
So, of course, we are keeping our eye on the story that everyone is keeping their eye on right now. Former President Trump is being arraigned today in New York City. The former president will be fingerprinted, will learn the charges against him, and plead likely not guilty. Not expecting any handcuffs or mug shots, but of course there is a big hullabaloo right now in New York City, and I just want to mention that because we are keeping our eye on it in case anything happens.
Yeah, and this is truly historic. It's the first time a president will be criminally charged. People are already out there. They're protesting, and we will take live special coverage beginning probably around 2 o'clock today, so you can listen right here on 90.9. So it's been a few days, but our region, Avi, we're still recovering from historic storms over the weekend that left devastating damage in New Jersey and Delaware. One person died in Delaware. The National Weather Service confirmed that 6 tornadoes touched down in New Jersey on Saturday, one of the biggest single-day tornado events on record. The record is in 1989. There were 7 tornadoes then. New Jersey's average is about 2 tornadoes for the entire season. That's according to NewJersey.com. And in Delaware, an EF3 rated tornado, which has winds about 140 miles per hour, it tore through Sussex County. It blew roofs off. It leveled some houses. Some trees went down. That person died. The strongest tornado in 60 years. And I have to say, I was in Newcastle County, and it was pretty scary there, even though the worst of it was in Sussex County.
Yeah, scary stuff. And as you mentioned, this was sort of surprising to me that New Jersey averages only about 2 tornadoes for an entire season. So 6 in New Jersey in one day, and this is the beginning of the tornado season. And it's a bit cliche, I suppose, to mention at this point, but of course, we know that all of these things, the intensity of storms, the frequency of storms, is connected to our changing climate. You can't say for any individual storm that it's caused by climate change, but it's just a reality that every time we have something like this happen, we are seeing perhaps evidence of the way our planet is changing.
Yeah, I got to mention and shout out the Red Cross. They're helping the folks who have been displaced down in Delaware and beyond. And the one silver lining that I've seen sort of when this type of tragedy strikes is that people step up. The community comes together and people help out their neighbors.
Speaking of which, you set me up there. So there's a new study about people helping people.
Yeah.
It's based on census data. Okay. So AmeriCorps and the U.S. Census got together and they collected some data about where people are most likely to help out a neighbor. And it's called informal helping, which is like doing a nice thing for a neighbor, maybe babysitting, cat sitting, you know, little niceties that you do for someone on the block. And apparently, contrary to stereotypes, Philadelphians are at the top of the list for helpfulness and volunteering. Did that surprise you? All the cities in the country, Philadelphians are among the most likely to do these little tasks.
Well, when I first moved here, yes, I would have been very surprised. But now that I've been here, Philadelphia is one of the most generous cities I've ever lived in. People who have nothing, will help their neighbor.
Like, and you've lived around.
I've lived around. And I mean, people will help you. Yeah. Like, I lived in South Philly. My neighbors were very helpful to me. And, you know, we kind of sat on the stoop, chitted and chatted and all that, you know. So, I'm not surprised. And I'm very happy that Philadelphia is on that list. And, you know, speaking of South Philly, the city will dedicate a ceremonial road sign to Grammy-winning Philadelphia music legend James M. Toomey. He passed away in January of last year. He's a South Philly native. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know who he is, he was a jazz, R&B, funk musician and producer. He worked with folks like Stephanie Mills, Roberta Flack, Donny Hathaway. And one of his most popular songs, we're about to play that. But by the way, it's the 1500 block of Wharton Street that will get renamed to James and Toomey Way. But here's Juicy Fruit. Take a listen. Are you shoulder bumping right now?
Of course, of course. And it's interesting. I feel a little ashamed because I came to his work through the sampling of his work. So that song, Juicy Fruit, is, of course, famously sampled in Juicy
yes.
by Notorious B.I.G. And so I kind of had to work backwards to figure out who James M. Toomey was. But he's incredibly prolific and well-deserving of having a street named after him in South Philly. So congratulations to his family, his legacy being preserved there.
Yeah, and now we're going to talk about something a little bit more serious.
Yep.
Ghost guns. It's a mounting problem across the country and in our region. Philadelphia police recovered 571 ghost guns in 2021, double from the previous year. And ghost guns are guns that people can order online. They come in separate parts and they can easily assemble them with just a few screws. And they're really hard to trace.
So last year, there was an attempt by President Biden who issued an executive order that was supposed to crack down on ghost gun sales and manufacturing. But it has left some loopholes. Two new bills introduced in the Pennsylvania House by our next guest are trying to fill the cracks, close the gaps. Representative Morgan Cephas represents West Philadelphia's 192nd District and co-sponsored the bills. She is here with us in the studio to tell us about them. Representative Cephas, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be first up in studio.
Oh, yes. So let's dig into House Bills 776 and 777. They're designed to close these loopholes that Avi mentioned. What exactly will they do?
So thank you for the question, and thank you for your focus on this issue. You all reported on this last year about just the increase in influx of these style of guns coming into our community. And, you know, they're essentially similar. I mean, it gets at the crux of the issue of guns that are untraceable flooding our communities. And as you saw, there's been an extreme uptick. Back in 2016, there were less than 100 of these style guns recovered at crime scenes or at our gun buyback programs. But again, you're seeing that influx. And what the bill, what both bills essentially do is it adds one, a criminal code that will, one with the ghost guns, create a felony of the second degree if you are found selling, manufacturing, or purchasing essentially unregulated firearms. And again, it's the ghost gun kits that President Biden was trying to get at. They come in parts, so technically they're not considered firearms, but under his new regulation on the federal level, we'll be doing the same thing at the state. The pieces will now be considered firearms as well, which will require a serial number, but also will require background checks, which is essentially how people were getting around with purchasing. Like literally a 10-year-old could purchase a kit because, again, there is no background checks, no identification required. So that's what 776 does with ghost guns. Now, when we're talking about House Bill 777, that is untraceable firearms that are created by 3D printers. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that has been, you know, a humongous issue. And what the bill does, again, it creates a felony of the third degree if, again, you are purchasing, manufacturing, or selling a firearm that is entirely created by a non-metal substance. And again, it's trying to get at the crux of that issue.
So if these bills were to pass and I had illegally, let's say without licensure, without the proper background checks, purchased one part mm-hmm. of what could become a ghost gun.
Yes.
I would be potentially committing a felony there?
Yes,
okay.
You would be. Because again, it requires a serial number by a licensed manufacturer, and you have to go through a background check for that piece. And again, it's really defining each piece of the gun as a part of the Gun Safety Act, essentially.
And so let's talk about the politics of this, because Democrats have a very slim majority in the House.
Yes.
What is the likelihood that these bills will get passed? They'll and go to the Senate and end up on Governor Wolf's desk.
So, well,
Governor Shapiro. Oh my goodness, Governor
Times
Shapiro's
are changing.
Desk.
Times
no,
are changing.
Have changed. Yes. No, listen. I mean, the great thing about Governor Shapiro is that when he was Attorney General, he was mm-hmm. leading on the issue of ghost guns and had, you know, really talked about it and been at the forefront of, you know, ensuring that we regulated them similar to how the federal government is going to regulate them. So, thinking glass half full. Mm-hmm. We will get these through the House. But again, it's going to be, there's still going to have to be ongoing conversations because we do have Democrats in our own caucus that have a different experience and different perspective.
They're skeptical about this legislation.
I would say mm-hmm. open for more for further dialogue about the conversation. But I think what really puts us in a driver's seat this season is that we really have an opportunity as Democrats that we've been talking about nationally, mm-hmm. really leading and setting the agenda to address the influx of guns and the lack of safety around guns that we're experiencing here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And it's not just a focus on these particular rules and regs. For the first time, we're having a conversation yeah. about lost and stolen. We're having a conversation about safe storage. You know, we've seen an influx of young children that are getting access to guns that are, you know, miscellaneously left around or easily accessible. We're for the first time having a conversation about that, as well as red flag laws that we really want to be able to discuss. So, you know, as we're in the majority, again, we're able to set the agenda. God forbid, have a hearing mm-hmm. on the bills.
Can we drill down on that? Because,
sure.
Look, I know you're not going to say it, but a skeptic or you know, someone with maybe a more realistic look
right.
on how the chambers work in Harrisburg will say, look, it's great that you can do this in the House, but it's not going to get through in the Senate, which Republicans control, yeah. and therefore this legislation will never pass. But even if that's true, mm-hmm. is there something you can do to elevate this conversation now about ghost guns that you could not do when you introduced this legislation mm-hmm. prior? Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, having conversations like this and, you know, raising awareness about, again, what our challenge is here in the city of Philadelphia, what the challenge is here is in Pittsburgh County, and having a conversation that crosses the entire Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and not just making it an urban conversation, but making it a suburban and rural conversation. And again, this is the very first time since I've been elected that I'm actually able to have a conversation with the majority chairman, who is Tim Briggs, and say, can we have a hearing specifically about this topic? Previously,
couldn't even have a hearing before.
Yeah. Could not have a hearing at all. Literally, the Republican, his Republican counterpart, went on record and saying, I will never bring up a gun-related bill in my committee as long as I am the chair.
Yeah, and I want to throw this in there because we only have about less than a minute, but Philadelphia has been, activists here have been
Absolutely.
Saying they can't do anything because Harrisburg isn't on board. Does this get us one step closer to Harrisburg being on board?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, just last week you had the City Council of Philadelphia asking, calling on the General Assembly to remove preemption, to allow for Philadelphia to at least regulate its own gun laws because we have this unique challenge. And, you know, preemption is a long stretch,
mm-hmm.
But it's good when we have City Council, our district attorney, police commissioner, and our mayor all in unison speaking about an issue that we think can move Philadelphia forward.
We will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Absolutely. Representative Cephas.
Coming up, the Humble Diner is a beloved cultural institution, especially in New Jersey. We're going to be talking about the history, what your go-to diner orders, 477-9499. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, I've been thinking a lot about diners recently.
Oh.
My beloved childhood diner, the Tasty Diner in Silver Spring, Maryland, just Aww. Announced its closing after 80 years. I got two diners in my neighborhood mm-hmm. that are facing at least uncertain futures, perhaps closing. And it's just got me thinking about diners and what they mean to me and how special they are, a slice of Americana. And I want you to imagine the inside of a diner, counter to sit at, mm-hmm. big plates of breakfast. You got the the server going around with the coffee and the orange lid and people catching up and drinking tons and tons of coffee, refill after refill after refill. The regulars are ordering the usual. Those are just a few of the things that, I think about that come to mind for me when I think about diners.
Yeah, I think about pancakes all day because, you know, I can eat breakfast for dinner. So, you know, and I grew up in Maryland. We're both in Maryland and I love going to diners. College after the club, $5 for a pancake and eggs. I love that. So New Jersey, I don't know if you knew this. You probably did, Avi.
I did, yeah.
It's the diner capital of the world. I bet a lot of you all didn't know that. And with over 500 diners in the state and a history of diner manufacturing, there's something very Jersey about the humble diner, apparently. And that's according to our guest, Michael Gabriel. He is a writer and author of stories from New Jersey diners and the history of diners in New Jersey. And Michael is here. Welcome to Studio 2.
Having me, I really appreciate it.
So before we talk to Michael, we want to mention our lines are open. Listeners, we want to hear what you love about diner culture, maybe your order, your favorite spot, a diner memory. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email address is studio2@whyy.org. And Michael, maybe we should start here before we go too far. Let's get, you are a diner expert. What is your definition of a diner?
There are a lot of definitions of diners. I'm partial to the idea of always having a counter, always serving breakfast. But you could get into definitions about whether the diner was built in a factory and how long it's open 24/7. But I think the real definition of a diner is that it's a place where the community meets. It's a place where you make memories. It's a place it's got generational memories. You went there as a kid. Your parents took you there. You went there when you were in high school. You went there when you were working. You go there when you want to meet your friends. So that's what a real diner is. That's what a real New Jersey diner is. It's a place where you have your memories and you meet people, your friends, and sometimes you meet people for the first time. It's a very friendly, egalitarian institution. In other words, everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome.
One of the things that really made me interested about this segment is the fact that a long time ago, when diners were kind of cropping up, eating out was a thing that people did if they were wealthy, and the diners sort of made it for everybody. Could you give us a little bit of the history there?
Yes, it's strange to think, but when lunch wagons, the precursor to diners, when they started getting popular, the idea of eating out was a pretty radical concept. Like you say, rich people ate out. They ate at the Waldorf Astoria. They ate out at fancy restaurants. Working class people, blue collar people, they couldn't afford to eat out. But at a lunch wagon and then later at a diner, you could afford to eat out. In fact, you could take your whole family and eat out. It's basically good, wholesome American food, good service at a reasonable price. So people could eat out. And then that began the whole concept and the whole spirit of the diner, people going there, visitors traveling there, truck drivers stopping there. It's a real Americana story.
Yeah.
And the diner, and as New Jersey became the corridor state, you got to go through New Jersey from Philadelphia to New York. New Jersey in the early days of the 20th century invested in its infrastructure. So good roads, good highways, good bridges, good tunnels. And that traffic, that motors traffic, is what basically that's the lifeblood. That's the customer base for diners.
And then I understand that in Bayonne, New Jersey, there was this guy. I think I have his name right, Jerry O'Mahony.
Yes.
Who had a critical role in establishing, I guess, that transition from the lunch wagon style diner to like the permanent structure diner. Tell me about Jerry.
Jerry was quite a guy, and I was very fortunate to meet his granddaughter, who helped me a lot with research and photographs. Jerry and his family, they owned a restaurant in Bayonne, which is right on the Hudson River, looks out at New York City. Jerry had a restaurant, and he and his brother decided to go into the lunch wagon business because it was getting popular, and they became pretty good at it. They had anywhere from 5 to 7 lunch wagons at one time. Jerry didn't have a lot of formal education. He wasn't really a businessman, but he was pretty streetwise. And he soon understood that the real money to be made in this lunch wagon business and later the diner business wasn't so much in operating a lunch wagon or a diner, but building a lunch wagon or a diner. So I think it's fair to say he's the great grandfather of New Jersey's diner business. He was one of the first lunch wagon builders and certainly was the first diner manufacturer. He and his brother and a family friend who was a master carpenter, they built diners in Jerry's backyard, and they became so popular that he had to expand into some factories in Bayonne. Pretty soon he got very popular and had to go to a big factory in Elizabeth. So that's his story, and it's a great story. And he, from what I understand, he was quite the guy, very generous guy, and really he set the gold standard for diner manufacturing.
And since we're talking about the actual diners, the structures, we have someone on the line, Manny Montero. He is a chef, and he owns an actual diner. It's called Chemung Diner and Restaurant. It's located in Chemung, New Jersey. Manny, thank you for joining us on Studio 2. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
Yes.
Thank you, Michael, as well. It was great listening to you introduce the diner.
You're a good guy.
So Manny, you've been the owner of your diner for 17 years. What has the year been like for you?
Well, the diner business was awesome when I first took over in 2006. That's when I purchased the diner in January 2006. And it was a great deal. Unfortunately, COVID hit us and things went a different way. And so it's been a struggle. Things are coming back, but unfortunately, costs have gone up, wages have gone up, and so it's kind of a little of a challenge.
Talk to me about some of the things on your menu, Manny, because one of the things I love about diners is the fact that they often have big menus, mm-hmm. and diverse menus. Tell me about what you've got on your menu and what makes you guys a little bit different.
Well, our menu is very different compared to most diners. I'm originally from India, and so I actually offer Indian cuisine as well, which is very different from diners, for most diners. So we have the regular diner foods, you know, turkey and stuffing and gravy and mashed potatoes and beef, roast beef and all of those things and crab cakes and everything else and... You know, we have the gyros, and we have all this stuff. So we have a lot. My menu is very diverse. And being on 206, it's a great spot. I meet people from all over the country, actually, who go by to Atlantic City or visit or, you know, and sometimes even people from other parts of the world who are going down to Atlantic City. So.
Manny made me a tally sampler platter when I was there the last time.
Wait, what's that?
It sounds
delicious.
So good. Yeah.
Yeah, the sampler platter is called a thali. A thali basically is a platter in Hindi. It's made up of, we have a chickpeas, which is called chana masala, the lentil, which is called the dal, the potato and cauliflower, which is called the alu gobi, a plain rice, a yogurt salad, which is a raita, and then a rice pudding for dessert, and also comes with a naan, which is the bread.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. And Manny, I have to ask you one more question. I mean, part of what makes diners special is it's not like fast food. It's food that is fast, but there's also a community. You feel like you're at home visiting a friend. Talk about you being one of the few, if only, diners in your area, and what has that been like growing this community around you?
The town of Chemung is amazing. I know some people can't even say it, but Chemung is an amazing town. It's a very small town, and the people are very close-knit. They're very supportive of their local businesses. Yes, I'm the only diner in town because it's a small town, but there are diners around, not too far from me. But in this community, the residents of the town are very, very supportive. I mean, everybody comes here for everything. I've completed 17 years, and I'm on my 18th year here, and I've seen, just like Michael was saying, you know, they come with their parents, then they come with their as they go to college, they come with their girlfriends, then they come with their wives, then they come with their wives and their children, and it's amazing. You know, I've been able to experience all of that, and it has been a great experience, really speaking.
Well, thank you so much, Manny. That's Manny Montero, chef and owner of the Chemung Diner and Restaurant in Chemung, New Jersey. And we are speaking with Michael Gabriel. He is writer and author of Stories from New Jersey Diners and the History of Diners in New Jersey. Michael, can you react to Manny's story about this community aspect of being a part of a diner?
Manny's a good guy. I've been to his diner a couple of times. He's got the right spirit. He's got the right attitude. Mm-hmm. The community supports him. Here's a quote for you. A diner is more than just a place to eat, and food is only half the meal.
Mm. I love that.
The other half is the community, the customers, the waitresses, the owners, the place itself, the atmosphere. Here's another quote. When you start a restaurant, the restaurant owners are very concerned about the atmosphere. When you have a diner, the customers create the atmosphere. There's two quotes for you.
Speaking of customers, we've got folks emailing in talking about their favorite diners and their favorite diner orders. Maddie emailed shouting out the dining car in Frankfurt and says he gets the potato pancakes and the fat Elvis cake.
Ooh.
From the dining car in Frankfurt. Mary said, I went to college in Pittsburgh and Ritter's Diner was an institution. Mary has fond memories of late night visits with a dozen or more friends or Sunday mornings with French toast coffee. Total $2.10 in the early 1990s. One thing I wanted to touch on there, Michael, is sort of the intersection of diner culture and late night food culture. To
yes.
me, that is so essential. Like going to the diner at some desolate hour, either by yourself or with a small group of friends, and maybe being alone but not feeling lonely. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that. Do you late night dining anymore at diners?
Once in a while, I used to do more of it. that's part of the mystique. It's part of the mythology of diners. It's the idea that, you're sitting at the counter and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and in walks a truck driver. And it's just like, oh my God, I haven't seen you in 20 years. We used to go to high school together. Yeah, that's right. And it's, or else it's the Humphrey Bogart kind of character, a guy with, he's got a big brim hat and a trench coat and he walks in and it's like, give me a cup of coffee and don't give me any trouble.
Yeah.
That's part of the mystique. I always tell people, you really want to see a diner at its best? Yeah, go there at 2 o'clock in the morning. But you know what? It's kind of sad. Very few diners are now open 24/7. Not all diners used to be, but nowadays in particular, it's very hard because of cost, because of trying to get the right help, training the customers. It's expensive. It's a tough business. It's long hours. It's hard work and small profit margins. So yeah, but if you can find a good diner that stays open late, you're always going to get quite an experience, a meal and a show. And the people who go to diners, it's like ships passing in the night. There's always an Americana story to be told and somebody interesting to meet.
Yeah, and we want to hear from you. What's your favorite spot? What's your favorite order? You can call us at 888-477-9499 or email us at studio2@whyy. And we have a caller. Daniel has something very cool to say, and involves grilled sticky buns.
Yeah.
Well, we don't
Perhaps
have Daniel.
Daniel's not with us, but I wanted to pick up a thread that you mentioned earlier, Michael. You talked about the fact that a lot of diners are not open 24/7 anymore, and it does seem like the diner business is morphing, if not declining. I mean, what's your sense of where the diner business stands now relative to 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago?
The business is always changing, just like any business.
Yeah.
You could say maybe 25, 30 years ago, maybe New Jersey had 600 diners. Today, maybe 500 diners. But diners come and go. They get torn down. They get picked up and moved across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe. But then there are new diners that open. So it's part of the process. 125 years ago, everybody loved lunch wagons, but then lunch wagons evolved into diners. Where are we going to be 50 years from now? I don't know. I hope we still have a good handful of of the vintage stainless steel diners, but there'll be new diners and new memories and new people running diners. So it's an ever-changing business. And yeah, when you get, when your diner closes, or when it doesn't stay open as late as it used to, it's a little sad, but it's kind of like a home away from home. But things change, but people adapt, and you never know where it's going to go.
So you think it will endure? You think the concept will endure in some form?
I think there will always be a type of place where people can go, stop in on their way from here to there. They don't want a big sit-down meal. They want just maybe a cup of coffee, a slice of pie, a hamburger, something quick, and maybe a nice little 10 minutes of chit-chat, and then be on their way. There'll always be a place like that. That's part of the American spirit.
Yeah.
I don't know what the diner business is going to look like, but I'm confident. I think it's going to be around for quite some time, and that's a nice thought to have.
Yeah, I have to ask about the decor, because every diner that is ever, they always catch my eye. They usually look like trains. They have some other type of retro vibe. Talk about the decor and what people use to sort of draw folks in off the street, how diners did that historically, and how they keep doing that.
Yes, the diners look like train cars. And in fact, they used to retrofit old trolley cars to become diners. But for the most part, diners are built in factories, prefabricated and modular eateries that include all the essentials, the kitchen, all the utilities. And way back when, the diners used to throw in cups and silverware and plates. The diner concept, as it was taking shape in the 1930s and the 1940s, it took on this, there was a architectural philosophy called streamline modern, kind of a subset of other architectural concepts. But the idea that you're trying to capture speed in a design, it's the horizontal lines, the rounded corners, the glistening stainless steel. And the diner builders, they took advantage of that. They were big on neon lights and the glass bricks and the beautiful tile work. And they used to have real marble countertops back in those days.
Wow.
We are talking with diner authority, Michael Gabriel. And our phone lines are open here at Studio 2, 888-477-9499. Right now, we're going to try one more time to bring in a caller, Brian from Smithfield, New Jersey, who I believe has a tie to diner history. Brian, what's your comment here on Studio 2?
Hi, thank you for allowing my call. I don't know much, but I do know something, and it's my great uncles, and it's the Federo and Bonavita families. Together, I assume this was in the late 40s, they were early 50s, before I was around. They took the dining cars from the railroad, the stainless steel dining cars, and they converted those into diners.
Mm-hmm.
And so the original dining cars from railroads, you see that we have one in my town, believe it or not. So there'll be a stamp, a stainless steel stamp in the car, and we'll have, say, Federo Dining Car Company. Those are the originals.
It's true. That's an interesting story,
Brian.
Michael, does that sound familiar? The idea of remodifying these old train cars?
Yes. They did that, or maybe they borrowed parts from it. But like I said, for the most part, diners were built, as diners in factories. Federo was a great diner manufacturer. Started out in Newark, and then eventually ended up in Bloomfield, New Jersey. And probably the most famous, there's probably two most famous Federo diners. One is down the shore in New Jersey on Long Beach Island, Mustache Bill. That's a Federo diner.
I love it.
Mustache Bill is the gold standard of diner men. He's a diner man's diner man. And then in New York City, in the Chelsea section, you got the Empire Diner. Big diner, beautiful diner. That's a Federo diner. So Federo, Jerry O'Mahony, Silk City and Patterson, Cullman, these were some of the big diner manufacturers in New Jersey. They all took root here because this is where the business was.
Yeah.
There were other diner manufacturers, but we had the most in New Jersey. So I always tell people we're the diner capital because of the number of diners, But in the 20th century, we were also the diner manufacturing capital of the world.
Yeah, made in New Jersey. Got to shout out Sammy, who says... Got to shout out Sammy, who says the best thing about diners to me is the music. That is the jukebox. Love that. We also got an email from Lee who said, I started going to the Colonial Diner in Woodbury, New Jersey after church with my mom, then would go with friends in high school. And now when I come back home, I still go back. It reminds me of home, family, and friends. And we also be having Manny on the line. We have a comment from Bull from Vincent Town. And I think Bull had a comment on Shemong. Hi, Bull. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I'm just happy to hear Manny on the from Shemong Diner. I love that place. Been going there for years and appreciate the vegetarian options they got there. I've been vegan for over 30 years, and I feel like a lot of the diners have really been creative and welcoming in that respect.
Thank you so much, Bull. We have to leave it there. I'm going to thank our guest, Michael Gabriel, writer and author of The History of Diners in New Jersey. Michael, thanks for joining us on Studio 2. Coming up, we have a little bit more on food for thought and our emotional well-being. An interview ahead on Studio 2 from WHYY 90.9.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. A new book shows overwhelming evidence that what we eat impacts how we feel, not just physically, but mentally. Our contributor, Mary Cummings Jordan, sat down with Mary Beth Albright, author of Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being.
Your book is about the art and science of what and how to eat for emotional well-being. Let's talk about the food-mood connection. What is that?
Well, with one foot, we have ourselves in the most ancient wisdom, which is that food and mood are connected. And with the other foot, we have ourselves in the past 20 years of this explosive research that's happened to show that food and mood are entwined like vines. How you feel affects what you eat, and what you eat affects how you feel. And one of the most exciting things to me is that this happens independent of weight and weight loss. So it's not a diet culture message. It's just a food affecting emotional well-being message.
We've heard a lot of negatives about the Western diet in recent years, Mary Beth. Is there evidence that what we generally eat in our culture can be linked to poor mental health?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's not just in our culture, it's spreading, right? That typical Western diet, the standard American diet, otherwise known as SAD. A lot of this goes back to ultra-high processed foods, which, according to some estimates, is 60 to 70% of the American food supply. And when you say ultra-processed foods, it really means, you know, things that are industrially processed, things that come in a box with an expiration date a year away. The ultra-high processed foods seem to be wreaking havoc. And a lot of that is due, they think, to industrial ingredients in those ultra-high processed foods, that when you make oil industrially, there's something about the chemical change to that oil that the body reacts to it differently than, say, you know, a fresh pressed olive oil.
Yeah. So I've read in your book, Mary Beth, that ultra processed foods can cause inflammation in the body. How can inflammation affect our mood?
Mary, inflammation anywhere in the body can affect our emotional well-being. And this is one of the great discoveries of the past 20 years. there's something called the blood-brain barrier, and it's a bunch of very tightly connected cells that protect the brain from all the toxins that are floating around in our blood. We found out over the past few decades that the blood-brain barrier is not impenetrable, so very small compounds can get through from the blood into the brain. And one of those compounds are inflammatory compounds that are in the blood when there's inflammation anywhere in the body. You cut your finger, it gets warm, it gets red and hot. That is your immune system at work. There's a lot of evidence that the typical American diet and the typical Western diet can lead to inflammation. And it's not necessarily inflammation that you can see. You know, some people think that inflammation is, well, you should be able to see it, right? You should be able to see swelling. And a lot of times this is happening internally and you can't see it and you don't know it's there.
So can this sort of diet then lead to some sorts of depression, anxiety, low mood?
Well, the studies that they're doing that are really recent over the past 5, 6, 7 years show that when you have people who are standard Western diets and they have clinical depression or diagnosed anxiety and they switch to a Mediterranean diet, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fatty fish, there is a decrease in the symptoms of depression and anxiety. And the first trial that happened with that is called the SMILES trial, and that was about 5 years ago, showing the decrease of symptoms. It was a shot heard all around the world. And now people are going even more into this research, even more deeply. What we know right now is that this whole foods diet can reduce the incidence of depression and anxiety alongside of making people who don't have clinical depression feel better.
Most of us don't give a whole lot of thought to our digestive system, but it is tied to emotional well-being as well. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So this is one of the great things. The gut microbiome is the collection of trillions of microorganisms that are living in your digestive tract. And that's from your mouth all the way down to the other end. And these trillions of microorganisms are their own kind of thing. They're individual living, eating, metabolizing beings. And what they do inside of our body is such a mystery right now, but we know that they are linked to things like social anxiety, sleep, how well you sleep. For some people, how much exercise they can tolerate. Your entire digestive system is like a factory. The food is the raw materials, and those microbes in there are helping you digest it and make things that completely influence the way that you feel.
Mary Beth, you also write about how the environment of a meal, food preparation, the aroma, the setting, all this can also affect emotional well-being. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, Mary, because flavor is created in the brain. What we bring in to our nose, like the molecules of the food, things like what you hear, what you see. I mean, all those sayings of, you know, you eat first with your eyes, it's true. And there are a lot of great experiments that I talk about in neurogastronomy, which is a new field that is just the study of how the brain creates flavor. One of the studies is they fed people stale potato chips. And as expected, the people thought they were pretty gross. But when you piped in noises of people eating, of people crunching, the people who were eating those stale potato chips rated the potato chips as fresher. Coffee in a white cup will always taste better than coffee in any other colored cup. We don't know the mechanism. We don't know exactly why, but we can see this brain activity around food. And so food is really a fundamental part of our human pleasure existence.
Many of us, Mary Beth, dine alone quite often. It's just how our lives are structured. But you say when building emotional wellness, it's good when possible to dine with others. What's the benefit here?
Sure. I call this the feast paradox. In America, we all often associate eating more food with having worse health outcomes. But what we find with people who eat with other people, they eat more food when they're with other people, but they enjoy greater health outcomes. Whenever we eat anything, our bodies release dopamine. And that dopamine helps us bond with other people. And so you can either be sitting in front of your television and bonding with your television, or you can be bonding around other people. Look, I live alone a lot of the time. I don't eat every single meal alone. But once I saw this research I make it a point to eat at least one meal with other people in a group every day. And it's not easy. And it's so powerful that other countries, including the United Kingdom, including Australia, have started programs just to encourage people to eat together.
Let's talk for a moment about healthy eating and weight. Can inflammation lead to weight gain? And if so, Mary Beth, how do we explore the answers here without employing weight stigma?
Well, if we knew the answers to everything, we wouldn't need the book, right? So there's a lot we don't know. What I can tell you is that, for example, in the SMILES trial, people who were clinically depressed and found reductions in their depression symptoms when they switched to a Mediterranean diet, those changes happened independent of weight. It's not a diet culture message. And, you know, a lot of eating plans, quote unquote, will come along and say, oh, well, you know, it's not about weight loss, but you're going to lose 10 pounds, you know.
Yeah.
The weight stigma that happens in this world is terrible for people's emotional well-being. And that is the place that the book comes from, is how do I eat to improve emotional well-being?
Mary Beth Albright is the author of Eat and Flourish.
Thank you to Mary Cummings Jordan for that fascinating conversation about our brain-body connection.
I'm still thinking about the coffee cup thing. That's wild. Thanks to all of you for our questions and the comments this hour. We couldn't get to everything, but we love diners, and I'm glad that you do too. For more of our show, head to whyy.org/studio2 or follow WHYY on Twitter. The hashtag is studio2. Our producers today, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and our engineer is Diana Martinez. I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg in Studio 2 from WHYY in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us.